Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, Producer Jonah here. And just a reminder that after the guests have gone, the conversation continues on our Twitter, Insta, and Facebook communities. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this week's topic. In particular, Twitter has been heating up lately, so if you're someone who likes to get into the thick of the discussion, or just weigh in with a friendly, charitable voice, our Twitter handle is @pofcharity. Enjoy the episode!
Welcome to Principle of Charity. I'm Lloyd Vogelman and I'm here with my cousin and buddy Emil Sherman. We're here to inject some generosity and curiosity back into our conversations. Principle of Charity tells us to seek the truth, not win the fight. To first put aside our own views and try to understand the other viewpoint before we instinctively reject it. And every week we'll introduce a Principle of Charity personal challenge. The challenge this week is, can you enjoy being wrong? And can you let this help generate excitement and discovery in what others have to say, especially those that disagree with you? Emil, what's our topic for today?
Thanks, Lloyd. Our topic today is meditation versus psychoanalysis, which offers the best path to reduce suffering. So what do we do with our mental suffering, from everyday anger and disappointments to life-defining moments of grief and pain? You know, we're all dealing with our emotional life, much of which can be challenging. And in this episode, we're going to explore two great models, meditation and psychoanalysis, and look at what they have in common and how they differ. Meditation, particularly mindfulness meditation, has made its way into the West and permeates so much of society these days. The catchphrase mindfulness has become a mantra for how we're meant to approach everything, from how we eat to what we wear. But meditation itself asks us to do what many find unbearable, to simply sit and to become aware of our thoughts and feelings. In creating this little gap, we realize that, by definition, we are not our thoughts and feelings, and their grip on us loosens. Instead of being literally carried away by our anxieties and passions, a space opens up, and we have a vantage point from which we can choose to act and react differently. And this is where meditation generally stops, at a calmer, more peaceful, more in-control place. But Buddhism, the spiritual tradition we most associate with meditation, sees meditation as a key stone on the path to no less than spiritual enlightenment itself. The idea, as I understand it and have in moments experienced it myself, is this. Once we recognize that we're not our thoughts and feelings, once we open up that little gap of awareness, we go searching for what and where we really are, and soon find that the I of the ego does not in fact exist, that we are, to the extent that we are anything, just that state of awareness itself, always and eternally present, connecting us with everything. Now, psychoanalysis comes from an entirely different tradition, but weirdly shares much overlap with meditation. It too asks us to stop, to listen to our inner voices, and to create a gap of analysis between ourselves and the forces that move and shake us so vigorously. It sees humans as a bundle of contradictory impulses, with much of ourself deeply hidden within our subconscious, out of view of our conscious minds. It sees our suffering as coming from adaptations we had to form in childhood, which kept us safe and still keep us safe from painful feelings. And we can see them in our patterns of behavior, but we can only break their spell if we're prepared to open ourselves up to our subconscious and to the repressed and often painful moments that we hide from. And all of this plays out in the very live dynamic between the patient and the analyst. Now, psychoanalysis doesn't promise happiness. It just tries to loosen the grip of unhelpful patterns of behaviors and thoughts. It recognizes that suffering is a part of life, and it helps us to a life of greater depth, meaning, and growth. Lloyd, I am fascinated by this topic as I've been both practicing meditation as well as been in therapy for quite a while, probably too long. And I know that you've recently gone deep into meditation and you have a background, of course, in psychology. And so many of our listeners would have tried meditation and various forms of therapy, including psychoanalysis, with the hope of reducing suffering and improving quality of life. Lloyd, who do we have to help us through all of this?
Emil, our two guests today are Samaneri Jayasara and Sonia Wexler. Jayasara initially ordained as a nun in the Theravada tradition in 2002 and lived in monasteries in both Western Australia and the United Kingdom. She then left monastic life but re-entered it in 2018 at the Santi Forest Monastery, where she helped to further maintain and develop Santi as a monastery for female monastics. In 2021, Jayasara moved to the Viveka Hermitage in southern New South Wales to allow more focus on a growing online Dharma project she had initiated. Emil, she has now thousands of subscribers globally. Sonia Wexler, our other guest, is a clinical psychologist and child, adolescent, and adult psychoanalyst. And importantly for this episode, Emil, the emphasis is on psychoanalysis. She completed her psychoanalytic training with the Sydney Institute of Psychoanalysis. Sonia has worked and trained in Australia and the United States. She has degrees from both Boston and Macquarie University, and her clinical work focuses on both simple and complex difficulties experienced by children, adolescents, and adults. Emil, this is a fascinating topic. As you said, we both have skin in the game here. We've both been in therapy. We both meditate. But there's a lot of crossover also between these two traditions, but also so much that is very different. They have a different view on whether and how happiness can be achieved. And they also have a different view on the approach and treatment for mental health issues as well as suffering. In a sense, our two guests are both healers, both giving their lives to helping people. So I'm expecting, Emil, a charitable discussion. But it'd be really great to tease out the differences of these two approaches. Let's bring them on.
Thank you so much, Jayasara and Sonia, for joining us on this episode. Jayasara, let's start with you. Can you give us an understanding of meditation, how it works, how it might help reduce suffering? And we'll go to some of the more spiritual aspects a little bit later, but maybe just start with the sort of basics of meditation, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, it's a big question, and there are many, many levels and layers to it. But I think it's in a simplified way, the practice of meditation is about beginning to understand the way the mind works and to bring attention to that. And for many people, we kind of have this assumption that we know ourselves, but when people start to meditate, they often get quite surprised or shocked by the levels and layers of what's going on there. And Sonia would know this doing analysis, where you start to peel back the layers of the onion and uncover the shadow elements, the repressed stuff. So in many respects, it's a mental investigation, but it's more than just a mental. It's also looking at what's going on within the body and how we hold certain defenses within the body. And of course, you know, meditation encompasses, or you know, I guess the main part, depending on where you come to it at, it's really about the spiritual too. So starting to really understand the nature of reality. If you want to go to the depths of understanding meditation, it's about learning to investigate the nature of this so-called reality, what we take as reality, and all the assumptions and the conditionings that we've inherited from, in Buddhism, we'd say not just this life, but in many lives, and learning and investigating a much deeper reality to arrive at understanding what's called ultimate reality or the absolute reality. And it's only when we uncover the false that we could say that we can come out of suffering.
And so when you sit there and if you focus on a mindfulness meditation or focus in on the breath or something like that and you become aware of what comes up, that sort of gap that's created where you suddenly are not carried away by the sort of flow of your inner urges, but you have a gap of awareness that allows you to be less at the mercy of what's coming up.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, those gaps are, you know, for some people, just having a moment of where the mind's not caught up in its delusion and its conditioning processes is a great relief, you know. And I think that's why people turn to drugs, because drugs can do that. They provide long gaps, but they don't last, as we know, and they have all sorts of problems. But I think that's why, you know, people are constantly seeking relief from this mental torture. And meditation is just a much more effective, healthy, and ultimately long-term way to really embed that shift and to quieten the mind. But it's more than just quietening the mind, but that's the start. We need to quieten the mind so that we can see what's going on at the depths.
Sonia, let's come to you in psychoanalysis. I mean, what is psychoanalysis? A lot of people don't really know what it is, and, you know, we'll go to the other forms of therapy a bit down the track. But if we could focus on psychoanalysis, and how does it help reduce suffering? I mean, what's the promise of it?
Well, psychoanalysis is about facilitating self-awareness. A person comes to an analysis, I don't think they come because they want to. They come because they need to. The self-awareness that happens or occurs and is fostered in an analysis comes about through a focus on the patient's unconscious. And the unconscious exists irrespective of an analysis. It's just that it provides a frame in which to focus on it and examine it. The analyst, which is central to the analysis, provides an external frame for the unconscious, the patient's unconscious, and the frame exists. So it's not just the consulting room, it's the sessions, it's the frequency, it's the duration of the sessions, it's the breaks, it's the fee. They're the external frame. And then there's the internal frame, which exists in the analyst, which is that the analyst has had their own analysis. So they're aware of what's in them to the best of their ability. They've been a patient and they have a supervisor. So they have a third other examining their work and existing in their mind as well. And all these factors facilitate a frame in which the unconscious can be thought about and come to life. If a patient could come in, a person could come in and say, this is my problem and this is why, they wouldn't need an analysis. And but you hear people say, this is my problem, but they don't really know it at the depth in order to ameliorate their suffering. They need another person's mind to do that.
In a sense, we don't know ourselves, and the subconscious provides an avenue to better understand ourselves. But how does sort of understanding help us feel better? What happens? You unearth the subconscious. Maybe are you just in a greater world of pain?
Well, I mean, it's a good point, because I think that when a patient may begin an analysis, they can feel worse. I'm not doing a good job at selling analysis, am I? They can feel worse in the beginning. Yeah. But things do come up, and the idea of things coming up, things that they didn't know, whether it's memories, whether it's experiences, and then it actually maybe allows things to be worked through in a different way. So they're not carrying it around with them in the same kind of way. It's not just that it comes out, it's that it's how it can be worked with and understood.
So they were repeating patterns that come from places that they don't understand, that the conscious mind can't understand, and by bringing it out, you know, it sort of brings it into the light of day, and it gives them the tools in relationship with the analyst to be able to change how they live, change their relationships.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, Freud famously said that the aim of analysis was to transform neurotic misery to common unhappiness, which is not that you won't be unhappy. It's not that you're always going to be joyous. It's just that it feels a bit more manageable. You'll have the range as well. That's another thing, having the range of feeling joy and distress.
I mean, Jayasara, just looking at the more spiritual aspects, I mean, I guess many people are practicing mindfulness meditation as a tool to feel calmer, to take the bite out of difficult feelings, give us a greater sense of inner control or peace. But as I understand it within the Buddhist tradition, it's the promise is that it's a path or tool to the path to enlightenment, to a sort of deeper recognition that there is no self, and that the expanse of awareness that exists is all there is in the present. It's a sort of radical transformation that involves the dissolution of the ego. How do you see the more narrow secular practice of meditation within the context of the broader spiritual tradition?
People are coming at it as they would come to any sort of counselling or therapy. They want relief from suffering, And the mindfulness, we'll call it the mindfulness trend, I suppose. Again, there's many different levels of it being offered, but as a general sense, it's just offering people a way to be more peaceful. And often for a lot of companies, it's about making people more productive. So it kind of, in some ways, it kind of resonates with what Freud said, what Sonia just said about Freud's statement, just to move away from being unproductive, neurotic people to being kind of competent people in the world, but still with the ups and downs of life and accepting that. So I don't know how many people who pick up mindfulness, you know, a lot of people don't understand where it's come from, which is from the Buddha's teaching. And mindfulness is just one of the factors that he taught. It's not the whole path. So, but I think for a lot of people, they might come at it, be a little bit kind of skim the surface and then want to go a bit deeper. So it has that to offer from a spiritual perspective if people pursue it further and further. Because they realize that just being happy and making money and achieving your mundane goals isn't really going to make you happy in the long run, not deeply happy, because we all have to face our inevitable decline and demise. And, how do we move, face into death and losing people we love and losing our bodies, and the fact that we're all going to get old and sick. And a lot of the mindfulness stuff doesn't deal with that that dirty sort of stuff, that uncomfortable stuff. You've got to kind of take it all, really, with mindfulness. The Buddha's teaching, if you want it all, you have to look at the Eightfold Noble Path and all, everything that he taught, really.
But broadly, do you see the sort of secular, and I guess it is, could be like a capitalist productive tool, but it's also a tool to make people feel calmer and more in control. Do you see that as a positive force? Is it similar to yoga coming into the West, but people not understanding that?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's better than the opposite. Better than nothing? Yeah, absolutely. It's better.
Better than unmindfulness?
Or just, just kind of becoming mindless consumers and promoting any other sort of negative stuff. It's got a lot of positive stuff to offer. But it's just interesting because I've never come at it from that. I've always, I delved into it from the depths straight away. So I do wonder how it is for people who just pick it up as a kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, just kind of a tool for productivity technology. And technology, or another consumerist type tool. There must come a time where they go, oh, yeah, well, I've got everything. I mean, you just have to look at the people in the world who have got everything, the good looks, the success, the career, and they're not happy. There's still so much stuff within those sort of people that is incomplete. And so it'd be interesting to know how long this mindfulness craze is going to continue superficially, or whether it's going to allow people to go deeper and deeper, which I suspect it might.
At the risk of asking you the impossible question, but could you try to explain what that leap is from sitting with one's thoughts and feelings, the mindfulness experience, to a genuine Buddhist spiritual, understanding of reality?
These things happen spontaneously. There's no controlling this. But I think when someone really penetrates and has what you might call, a complete ego death and shattering, then, the whole fabric of reality turns upside down, even for a moment, then people realize that, okay, there's a lot more to this than just quietening my mind and feeling peaceful and feeling confident about myself. So I think when that happens for people, it can shake them up. But that can also happen not through meditation. It can happen through near-death experiences or deep, intense grief.
Drugs.
Yeah, all sorts of things. And then people go, oh, God, there's a lot more to life than, the way I perceive life than I thought. And that often starts people on a spiritual path.
Yeah, great.
Deeper exploration.
Sonia, can we come back to you and I guess go to the end goal of psychoanalysis? I mean, some people see it as a bit of a glorified, endless navel-gazing in a sense, that you mine the the knot of contradictory subconscious desires that make up yourself. But where are you left? What's the end goal? And is part of the aim just to know oneself better, even if it doesn't reduce suffering? And is that a sort of end in itself? Or is the aim to feel better? And if it's to feel better, is there evidence that it actually works?
I think there is an end goal. Yeah, I do. I don't think it's just a sort of an eternity in the sense of an analysis. But I think that the hope for a successful analysis is that the analysis can continue in the patient independent of the analyst.
Mm.
Right? That the patient has been able to internalize the ability to, in a sense, carry on the work. So in that sense, it does continue forever, hopefully. But the actual analysis doesn't.
Hmm.
It does take a long time, and I think that probably is what you're kind of referring to with the navel-gazing endlessness. It does take a long time because it takes a long time for understanding to happen, for the dependency that occurs in an analysis, the regression that occurs, and this is all if an analysis is going well, which I think is quite contradictory for people. If people hear about someone in a treatment where they feel, you know, stirred up, affected, bereft when their analyst goes on a holiday, there would be people outside of that would say, I think, what's going on? That doesn't sound good. But that's part of a good analysis, because that means something's happening, and that means that the person is working in the analysis.
So is that the trajectory that you're trying to deepen?
It is about deepening experience. It is also about lightening the person from what they can't get out of themselves.
Right.
And I think I was interested as Jayasara was talking, like there's a lot of overlap in that it is about facing the reality, one's own reality inside oneself.
Hmm.
And so at the end of an analysis, the work will go on in the person, but also that the patient can have more access to life and they have greater inner resources to do so.
I sometimes wonder if meditation can miss helpful clues that can keep us stuck. For example, you know, if difficult feelings emerge during meditation and what you do is sit with them and acknowledge them, but you don't engage with them in the way that therapy does, you might miss feelings that may come from a deeper trauma or an adaptation pattern. And without that knowledge, you don't have the self-knowledge to change. I mean, do you think meditation can miss things that psychoanalysis can help to uncover and shift?
Absolutely, and it does. And I've seen this in a lot of meditators. And when I was younger, I saw it in myself, because people pick up things wrongly, but you have to go through that and meet those obstacles and hopefully learn about them. But I guess it's what's called spiritual bypassing. So there's words like detachment in Buddhism, and people really misunderstand that term and think, well, therefore I shouldn't have any feelings and I should just cut off. And that's not the way to do it. And even with the concept of anatta or no self, people pick that up wrongly and think, oh, well, there's no self, everything's empty, therefore nothing matters. And then they can, in some traditions, you know, not so much within my tradition, because we have what's called precepts or moral practices that we uphold. But in some traditions where they don't have a moral anchor, they can just use concepts like emptiness and nothingness to do whatever they like. So it goes on all the time. And you know, I have to look at some of the gurus that have gone right off the well-known ones to see that this is indeed the case. So, yeah.
And do you think you have to engage with the self to move beyond it, or you could just forget about the self and just, you know, wake up?
Well, it depends what you mean by the self.
The ego, I guess, the sort of range of...
Well, we can't help but engage with the ego, because we're mostly operating out of that all the time. So it's there writ large. We just have to understand it. And then when we really understand it, we come to see that there's actually no such thing as the ego. It's all just an illusion. But we engage with the illusion nonetheless, what we'd call kind of the play and the display. These things are happening a bit like on a movie screen. You know, there's, 24 frames per second or something, 28 frames per second.
Right.
And it gives the impression of a continuity, of a continuous self. But in reality, when you go behind and sit in the box where the projector's being projected, you realise, oh, it's all single frames. And those single frames actually have no substance to them anyway. So we learn to understand this notion of what the ego or the self is, and it starts to dissolve and we have a better understanding of it. And therefore it doesn't, we don't fear it as much. It doesn't control our life anymore.
Yeah. And it's a powerful illusion, the narrative. I mean, I'm in the film and television business, so aware of the power of creating that illusion, and it can become our reality. I mean, Sonia, can I move to you and just sort of see if you could paint a picture of where psychoanalysis sits within the range of therapies. I mean, even before I researched this episode, I wasn't quite sure what psychoanalysis was as opposed to psychotherapy, as opposed to, I mean, I have an understanding of cognitive behavioral therapy, but what does it all mean?
What does it all mean? It's a very wide therapeutic world, isn't it? But essentially we can divide them up, you know, crudely, I think, between therapies that seek to, like CBT or more directive therapies that are about symptom reduction and are about, you know, skilling up a person, and they really have their place. Not everyone has the ability, or not just the ability in terms of practicality, but the possibility of having an analytic treatment. So for that reason, I think directive therapy such as CBT and ACT, which is, I think, acceptance commitment therapy or something. I'm not going to get that right. But those kind, that sort of bag of therapies have a very a real place and are very useful for people to make use of. They're about symptom reduction and they are about getting people going. That's one sort of subset. Psychotherapy, I think, probably is somewhere in the middle. It's a really mixed bag. I think it's really eclectic and people borrow things from different areas. I'm sure there are psychotherapists who will work analytically, some that don't at all. And so I think there's not a sort of uniform approach in terms of psychotherapy.
Yes.
And then psychoanalysis is in a sense the strictest, if you want to sort of say it in that way, because the focus is about self-awareness. It's not about making you happier. It's about, it's a long-term treatment. It involves frequent sessions and its aim is to facilitate self-awareness in the patient. It's a regressive treatment and it's at the center of it is the analytic relationship. And so that's why it takes so long. Well, that's part of the reason.
Seems to me both analysis and the sort of, I'm using meditation as a word that sits with, you know, for the broader tradition here, Jayasara, but they both share a focus on the here and now, on the experience of the present. And as I understand analysis, our unconscious patterns are meant to reveal themselves in the patient's relationship with the analyst. You're literally projecting your past and your subconscious within the room in the present. How important is the present relationship and that dynamic to the healing process?
Absolutely fundamental. There are reams and reams of books written about the transference, which is what you're referring to.
Transference, yeah.
Yeah, the transference, which is the patient's perception and experience of the analyst, because the analyst takes a particular role where they sit back, the patient doesn't know about the analyst's life, and they become not a completely blank screen, but they become a screen with which and a canvas with which the unconscious experience, past experiences come alive in the room. And then when they're alive, they can be better understood and they're more accessible and they have the chance to be worked with. They're not they're not talked about, they're right there.
And you can see them alive in the room if a patient is distrustful because of an early pattern, they then are distrustful of the analyst, and you can actually
you can work with that. Yes, exactly.
And I, you know, it would seem that the quality of the analyst becomes of paramount importance, because you're not a cognitive behavioral therapist who is providing tools that in some ways could almost become an app. You're doing it as two human beings alive in the room. Jayasara, how important is the guru or the meditation guide, or you know, we you mentioned that some of those people have not been anchored in the sort of moral framework and have gone awry. But how far can you go without that sort of guru or guide in the sort of meditation spiritual practice?
Well, it depends who you ask. You know, some teachers say it's impossible to go very far without a teacher, but many teachers have gone all the way without a teacher too. So
Right. There's
a lot of contradictions there. But those opportunities for projection and seeing where we project, you know, certainly from my tradition, and our teachers say that every moment is a moment to see that, and every person you interact with is a mirror of yourself. So if you're projecting some unresolved emotions onto even the stranger in the street, you know, they actually become your best teacher. So you know, when you pick up the Dharma like that, or the practice like that, it's everybody's here to teach us and for us to awaken to, and we are constantly projecting our unresolved stuff onto people, and it's an opportunity to awaken from that, you know. So everyone's our therapist, really. Everyone's our analyst.
If you can read the signals properly, but maybe if you need a teacher, if you...
Yeah, exactly. The teacher will point it out if you're a bit thick. But if the teacher's saying, look, you know, use everything to awaken. Nature is one of our greatest teachers, and nature has always been a great teacher for people, for masters to awaken. So we learn to listen, and we learn to read and understand what's going on and what we're projecting, because everything is just a projection of our minds. And when we start to accept that, then, you know, you don't need – I don't want to dismiss Sonia's wonderful skills and career, but you don't need an analyst if you everything is your teacher too. So but of course an analyst offers you skills that you might miss otherwise.
A meditation teacher offers you same pointers
thing.
where you've misread the teachings, or where you've misread yourself.
Yeah, and it's okay to misread. That's the thing. We've got to get it wrong. If we don't get it wrong, we don't learn. So you know, we've got to butt our heads against the wall and then wake up from it. So,
Jayasara, what's the role of meaning within the sort of Buddhist spirituality? I mean, our egos, the place of our hopes and dreams, the social relationships, feels to people who haven't taken the spiritual path as that's the playground of a meaningful life. And we want an ego that's well adjusted. And I imagine that's really what psychoanalysis is about, trying to create a better adjusted and a healthier ego, not to lose our ego. I mean, the ego can also be a lot of fun. I mean, I sometimes wonder if Buddhists are scared of getting hurt. Isn't the ego also a great place of meaning, fun, and enjoyment in life? Why would one want to give all that up?
The thing is, you don't give up the ego. You just really understand the ego. And one of the first deep signs of awakening is recognizing, seeing through personality view. And because we believe that we are these body minds, these personalities, and we think that's who we are. And we, you know, we either like them or loathe them, or depends what day of the week it is or what mood we're in. We like it or love it. We're high or low, we're up and down. And so when we, you know, the whole point is to see through that delusion. So when you're free from the delusion of believing in an ego or a personality, it's very liberating. Because you don't.
Can you enjoy it? Can you enjoy then?
Well, yeah, because you're not dictated. You're not dictated by it. It doesn't mean you lose a personality. You just don't take it seriously. You don't. One of my teachers said, "Don't take your life personally." And it's like that's a perfect teaching.
That's a great teaching.
You know, it's don't take it personally, because we aren't what we think we are. We think, you know, we're conditioned from day one to believe that we are these persons, these bodies, these minds, these emotions, these personalities. And, you know, if we get dealt a bad set of cards, we're miserable. If we get dealt a really good set of cards, we're conceited. But, you know, it's always a roller coaster ride if we believe in these personalities. So when we don't take them seriously and we don't believe that's who and what we are at a fundamental level, then that's what liberation is all about.
I mean, I guess, though, you are losing, slightly from the outside here, looking in, you are losing some of the buzz that goes with deep attachment, you know, from over-identifying with oneself, the sense that today is so important to me because I have a really important meeting, and if I do well, it'll really affect my life, and if I do badly, and you can sort of, or my relationship with a friend is of such importance because it gives me this sense of meaning and purpose, and or that sort of over-identifying with the self is the locus of a lot of richness in one's life.
Is it? I don't know. I think for me, it's like whenever you're really over-identified and attached to something, it's quite stressful. And you get really, really high and tight and tense. Whereas if you go, oh yeah, it's an important meeting. I know it's important. I'm feeling a bit kind of hyper about it. Just look at it properly, and then it can lose its sting, and it's much more peaceful then.
Is the aim, Sonia, to be peaceful and for things to lose their sting, or to be sort of more intense and richer?
You're talking about dichotomies, aren't you? You're presenting very different.
I am. I'm probably creating false dichotomies.
Oh, that is a false dichotomy. I think it is. I mean, I think your example, Emil, which is, you know, I've got a really important meeting. It means a lot to me. You know, it means an enormous amount to me. The question is, what does it mean to you, and why does it mean so much to you? Now, is it because everything that I stand for exists in this meeting? Well, I think that's rather unhelpful and right. And it also will probably mean that you won't do very well, because you can't live and die according to external decisions or external achievements. It's not going to be helpful. It's not going to be healthy. Mm. I think that's what JSR, I don't know if I'm right, JSR. I'm not
sure. Yeah,
if I'm,
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what
I'm. Attachment to all those things.
But it doesn't mean, like, from my perspective, I think having, you know, for things to be meaningful and for things to be important is fundamental to life, whether that's people, whether that's your work, you know, to not have that. Well, I think that's not in anyone's interests, but it's about the meaning of it and the significance of it and whether a person can manage it, where it comes from in them, I guess.
Yep. And not wanting to let external forces dictate your sense of self and your sense of safety and enjoyment for to have deeper resources.
Yeah, I mean, I think your example is a really interesting one, because a person might think, you know, this is going to make or break me in terms of myself or in terms of others. It depends where the judgment or the significance and the importance is coming from within the person. I think that maybe that that dissects it a bit. Because it's a good example, actually.
Is this the really important meeting, Emil?
I'm under a lot of
pressure.
Make
or break
here.
You.
I'm under a lot of pressure here.
Relax. It's not a big deal.
We'll book in for sessions after this. This is a little bit of a jump, Jayasara, into reincarnation, because I feel like I have an understanding of meditation in the secular sense and of the spiritual dimension that you talk about, and I've had experiences like that. But how essential is reincarnation to true spirituality? I mean, a lot of Western spiritual leaders feel you can uncouple enlightenment from reincarnation.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's not necessary to believe anything, you know, within Buddhism anyway. You don't have to believe in we call it rebirth. The Buddha taught about that. And it can be helpful. And some people have direct insights into seeing their past lives. But if it's kind of a bit weird and you don't want to accept it, that's fine. It's a bit like believing in ghosts. You know, in Asia, everybody believes in ghosts and a lot of people see them. And in the West, we're like, nah, don't believe in ghosts. And generally, most people don't perceive them. So it's not necessary. We can see rebirth happening in this life anyway, from moment to moment. You know, we're not the same person we were even, you know, this morning. Everything's changed. No. Science tells us where our cells are constantly changing. So we can see it happening from moment to moment.
I was thinking that meditation and psychoanalysis both place their trust in the actual experience of the person themselves. They're not ideologies that tell us what we should feel or experience. They're like pathways to revealing what's going on inside us. But at the same time, both do have pretty clear set of theories and guides that prompt us along the way. So So Sonia, I'm wondering, how do you see that line between suggestion and then overly influencing a patient to believe something? And, you know, just thinking about some of those false sexual abuse memories and times when analysts are prompting and creating experiences in patients.
I'm not sure I agree, actually, because I do think there is a danger, but I think in all intimate relationships, like an analytic relationship, for a kind of common mind and an understand, you know, wanting to please or colluding with one another. I think that's possible. I mean, the patient is asked, the patient's main task is just to speak whatever's in their mind. So mm-hmm. they direct the session. It's not, it's like the analyst doesn't even begin the session. Mm. They just bring whatever is in their mind to talk about, and the analyst can think and reflect what the meaning is.
But that has an influence, doesn't it? When the analyst says, well, have you considered your dream might suggest this? Mm. It's not a neutral statement, you know.
No,
you're in a vulnerable place as a patient, in a very, you know, connected with your subconscious, and you're like, well, actually, maybe that's right.
Well, I think that's right. I think that the analyst needs to know, and I think that we get taught how powerful our position is, and to be mindful that what we say has huge ramifications in how the patient hears what we say. We might think we're saying A, but the patient can hear B. So I think we're taught that, and that's where I think our own analysis comes in very keenly, because we have to know if we know ourselves and the dangers that we can fall into.
Jayasar, I think when I'm doing a guided meditation, for example, and told to look for the observer of my thoughts, I sometimes slightly feel like I'm being manipulated, that the prompt is almost forcing me to certain conclusions. But I'm told that, of course, it's a science which allows you to, you know, just get to understand and you know, the true nature of my mind, and it will be revealed to me. But yet there is this very strong prompt. Is meditation more of an ideology than it admits to being, or is the spiritual path more ideological than it admits to being?
Depends on your meditation teacher. I mean, people can manipulate and make suggestions within meditation, and but that example you just gave was more of a koan. Really, it was a question. You know, look. It wasn't telling you the answer. So, what was your conclusion, Emil?
Well, my conclusion is that I don't exist.
Don't you? Who's talking now?
Hopefully you'll tell me.
This is the fun part of meditation.
But there is a line there with the koan practice. There is a power in asking questions. I guess that's probably the question I'm asking to both of you, that you can't necessarily hide behind the innocence of asking a question, because they do create a framework within which, you know, answers need to be given. And they're both powerful questions. The questions of koans are powerful questions that provoke responses, and the questions of dream interpretation are very powerful questions themselves.
Well, we could just keep quiet and then you could just see what comes up.
Yeah.
And there'd be no question. And that's how a lot of teachers, real great masters, taught, just using silence. So the questions have always been, like in the Zen tradition, when Bodhidharma started teaching, they didn't have any of those koans or the huao to, what's called that, the huao to, which is the holding a question like, who am I? Who is carrying this corpse around? And they said they had to introduce them because people couldn't get it. we couldn't just kind of go, okay, look and see.
I'm giving you nothing.
And so it was just a skillful means, that's all. But they're open-ended questions where, to some extent, there is no answer to them, you know.
I guess that is a similarity to analysis where, as I understand it, Sonia, very strict analysis don't offer too much. They really try to force the patient to bring themselves to the room.
If you think about a session, you're hoping that the patient is talking a lot more than the analyst.
Yeah.
Because it's for the patient to speak and to find their way.
Yeah.
With assistance, but primarily it's it's the patient's time to speak, not to be professed to or to be taken in an opposite direction.
How does Buddhist meditation differ from the other meditative traditions within Hinduism and the spiritual traditions of Judaism and Christianity and Islam? How would you describe that world of spirituality and where Buddhism sits within all of that?
Well, they're all come out of such different traditions and paradigms and frameworks. So all the words, a lot of the practices are different. But as you perhaps know, Emil, from my YouTube channel, I include all the spiritual traditions in my readings and meditations because, you know, there comes a point where you start to understand that at their essence, they're all pointing to the same thing. They're just using different words, that's all. And then when people get into argy-bargy about who's better and what's the best and have religious wars, it just shows people's ignorance because if someone is a true master or has had true insight into reality, there's only one true reality. But they're all going to express it differently. And we just get attached to words and concepts. And then because we always like to feel that we're on the best team, we have to talk the other person down. So to me, the essence of all spiritual traditions, and to some extent, if it goes deep enough, it's where psychoanalysis and therapy goes. It'll go deep and you'll end up in the same place eventually.
Lloyd, I'm going to throw a question to you and then sort of leave the rest of the podcast for you. You know, you've recently become a meditation convert, as I understand, slightly obsessed, as you tend to get.
Uh-oh.
And you also have a doctorate in psychology. But, you know, briefly, what do you think the best path to suffering is, to alleviate suffering? How do you weigh up the pros and cons of the two models?
I've been reflecting on that quite substantively. I mean, I've been in therapy myself, was sort of somewhat trained in what would be called psychodynamic therapy. I've really only very recently discovered meditation and mindfulness. I feel pretty much like a novice. But for me, the power of meditation and mindfulness is I feel that it's almost a practice of life. And what I felt pretty frustrated with, and I'd love, Sonia, to come back to this a bit later in a conversation with you, is I sometimes feel that I'm not sure what I do with the insight. I often have felt quite insightful about myself, but haven't been able to apply it. I mean, I think of that even in my business world. I'm a coach to some very senior executives. I can coach them, but I could never do what I'm almost saying they should do. It's out of my depth. I mean, people write books all the time about in self-help, but they can't really do any of it. And so what is the jump between that self-insight and the actual day-to-day practice? And in one sense, I find that meditation gives me a little bit more of that. It puts a lot more onus onto me to be happy, to deal with my own thoughts rather than to almost have what I call a happiness contract, which is if only that would happen, I would be happy.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, over to you now, Lloyd.
What our listeners can't see because we are on Zoom is a picture of Jayasara and Sonia. And we often have very robust guests on the show who are quite opinionated, quite strong in their views. The experience that I have with both of you is that I feel there is just in your essence, a way of recognizing the value of others. It's hard to describe, but it feels like that. And that is one of the core principles of the principle of charity, is it's very hard to disagree and not get polarized if you don't recognize the value of the other. And so I just wanted to say to both of you, that was very, very striking, or is very striking. And I hope our listeners can experience some of that just in the audio. But let's go back to one of the things that we like to do on the show, and that is to identify in the principle of charity, what is the strongest argument of the other? And Jayasara, I would start with you. When you think about psychoanalysis or your understanding of it and what you heard today, what would you say the strongest points of Sonia's argument or psychoanalysis is?
I feel that the relationship is perhaps the most potent and transformative thing that's being offered in psychoanalysis. And if someone has already done a lot of work on themselves, which you have to do to be an analyst, and has gone through the pain and suffering of that has to be felt through that process, then they bring that compassionate heart into that relationship and become a really caring, supportive guide on that inner journey, because that inner journey is very frightening for a lot of people. And if it's not navigated properly, if we try to do it by ourselves, especially if people come in with a lot of unresolved trauma and try and figure it out ourselves or use very unskillful means, then that's going to go awry. So having a skilled listener and guide with a compassionate heart is probably the strongest thing that's being offered there. And the fact that that person is also willing to be in it for the long term is, kind of remarkable. It's not what's offered in a lot of therapies. It's, I know in London they give them really traumatized people with lots of things. Here's 6 or 12 sessions of CBT. You should be fine by now. At the end of it, and it doesn't work that way. So it's a commitment that's being offered, a genuine, deep commitment with someone who's already committed to themselves.
Wonderful. Sonia, what would you add? What do you think Jayasara has left out?
I actually think, Jayasara, you did such a great job. I thought that you really captured, really, honestly, about the essence of the analytic endeavor, really, and its uniqueness. And what sets it apart from other things and other treatments, it is the commitment. It is the commitment to a person for however long it takes. And that really does set it apart from other therapies. So no, I don't know if I've got anything to add. I think that's a really good summary.
When you think of Jayasara's position on Buddhism, mindfulness, what do you think the strongest point of view or argument, what would that be?
What came to me was when Jayasara said, but one of her teachers said, don't take your life personally. And I thought that was a really lovely reflection on how to manage what can feel to live a persecuted life or time of life. And so I was thinking about that. It really, there's a lot of overlap, of course, in psychoanalysis, but I was thinking that what really seems to be offered is something that is accessible. That's a very accessible way of thinking about things, and it would also be very, I think my sense is, very immediately helpful. I also really liked and what resonated in what Jayasara was saying, I felt that the idea of meditation and that a person can do it when they want, how they want, with someone else, not with someone else, I think the flexibility is very attractive and very useful. It's actually that's what I thought was a really big positive, that someone can really make use of it in an accessible way.
Jayasara, what do you think Sonia has left out or that you'd like to add?
Well, I think that the strongest part is that it's an opportunity for people to really fundamentally come out of suffering once and for all. And it may not happen this lifetime, but it's the path. It's because I guess in my tradition, the Dharma is seen as a precious jewel. So if one has access to that and is graced or given access to that, then you actually are being given the most priceless gift that you'll ever receive in your life. And then it's up to you to work with it and to uncover what it's pointing to. And I guess the flexibility is part of it. It's going to take some people many lifetimes. Other people might realize, wake up completely this lifetime. But if you've got it and you don't recognize that it's how precious it is, you're really throwing away a priceless jewel.
Part of the principle of charity is deep self-reflection, trying to find the truth. Both of you in your own different traditions are attempting to do that. What I would like to know is, and this is one of the things, Jayasara, I wanted to come to you and Sonia also, but when I hear often on podcasts or in meditations Buddhists talk and refer to the Buddha. I often wonder, is anybody critiquing the Buddha? Is anybody saying, no, this was a few hundred years ago. I mean, the Buddha couldn't have been right on everything.
Well, I'm not overly concerned, but, you know, it was more than a few hundred years ago. It was 2,600 years. And his teachings were never written down until at least 300 years after he passed away. So everything has to be taken in that context, that people change things. There were apparently amazing beings that had these memories that could remember the suttas, and they tried as well as they could to stick to what the Buddha said. But we know things get changed because people have different agendas. And so if you wanted to get into a scholarly thing, there are some really great Buddhist monks and nuns who have done that work and will show you where there's some inconsistencies. But that doesn't bother me, because I think one of the things we know for sure that the Buddha said in one of the famous suttas was, don't believe me. Work out your own salvation with diligence, and that you shouldn't ever believe someone based on tradition, hearsay, because it's in the scriptures. It's only when you know these things are true for yourself should you accept them. Mm. So, the Buddha wasn't asking you to believe or accept what he said. Test it out for yourself.
Yeah. What is the culture of disagreement, though, in Buddhism? Culture is way we behave. It sits there. It's often invisible. But when there is disagreement, what's been your experience in the Buddhist culture around disagreement, for example, around homosexuality or abortion? I mean, how do Buddhists disagree?
Well, there are so many different sorts of Buddhists and Buddhist traditions, Lloyd, and I know some of them can get pretty vicious, and I've heard that, but argumentative. But within my tradition, I guess there are many disagreements, particularly over the role of the ordination of women, for example, for the higher ordination. And sometimes it's got really split and nasty. Mm. But whenever there's a disagreement, if you come back to how the Buddha asked us to look at that, it was always to look at our own reactions and how much anger and hatred we're bringing into those disagreements. And can we have discussions, you know, like your whole principle of charity here, in a way that shows we're willing to listen and let go and not attach to views and opinions, because it's attachment to views and opinions that's one of the biggest obstacles on the path of meditation.
And Sonia, I mean, one of the big critiques, as I understand it, around psychoanalysis is that the claims that it actually help the patient cannot be tested. I mean, you've probably heard this over and over again. And that's, by the way, not unusual for many different parts of the world, whether it's diet or other dimensions of behavior. What's your view on that?
Well, I would actually dispute those claims, because I think that historically it was very, very hard to measure or research analysis. There has been a lot of research, and that was the criticism. It's not really true. I mean, there's lots of research about looking at analysis or looking at psychotherapy, analytic psychotherapy, and its effectiveness. And actually, I think Jonathan Shedler has done a lot of research on that, about, you know, the sort of long-lasting therapeutic gains that a patient gets from psychoanalysis versus other more short-term therapies. So it is the problem, I suppose, at times can be that every analysis is so different. It's not a manualized treatment, and for that reason, it isn't suited to a particular kind of scientific research. But I think we have enough research that continues on, and anecdotally, in knowing the therapeutic gains that patients get. I also think that a lot of effectiveness that comes out of other treatments overlap with what psychoanalysis brings, which is the focus on the relationship, whether it's, and it's called something different, the therapeutic alliance. But sometimes people can make use of that in shorter term treatments, but for other people they can't. So it is hard to test, but it's actually not true that it lacks a scientific basis in terms of research.
what I wanted to tease out after Emil's conversation was maybe just tease out how you would approach things practically. So if you don't mind, if you can just entertain this thought experiment for a moment. I've got an opportunity. We get an opportunity for Putin to come to both of you, Jayasara and Sonia. And he says, the world rests on both of your shoulders now. You've got 15 minutes with Putin. That's all you've got. What would you do in those 15 minutes?
Well, I'd ask him what he's here for and what he would if he's got any questions. I mean, he's highly unlikely to sit in front of me, and he would see that I'm a Buddhist nun. Okay, but what I would be doing internally, which you wouldn't see, would be that I would be practicing metta, loving kindness.
I see.
And probably recognizing the great suffering that this being is currently experiencing and probably going to inherit for many lifetimes to come through his actions. So without making too many judgments about that, I would hopefully feel some sort of loving kindness towards him and be able to generate that. And that if he wanted to ask any questions or sit in silence and practice meditation, I'd be happy to give him some guidance. But from what I understand, he's got some fairly significant health problems. He can't sit still. He can't keep his foot or his arm still for a second, apparently. They don't know if it's Parkinson's, but he's got a lot of things already manifesting in his body that are showing some signs of great stress.
But you would practice loving kindness and show that to him, but largely in those 15 minutes you would leave it up to him.
Of course. Yeah, well, I'm not going to give him a lecture.
You're not going to give him a lecture. Okay.
I'm not going to tell him what to do.
Sonia, what would you do in your 15 minutes?
If he said he was being forced, well, we don't have a patient, do we? If he said I came because it was a suggestion and I took it up, then potentially he's open to reflecting and understanding destructiveness and his aggression and a possible delusion. I mean, that's just what I read. And so I guess I would do something quite similar to Jayasara, in that I wouldn't be lecturing him, but I would ask why now and want to know what has led him to be where he is now, just so that I had an
understanding. I mean, I think that's, you know, I think that's interesting in both of your approaches, because what is true, I think, from the evidence, is when we try and influence people through lecturing them, it generally is inefficient, it's a waste of time, and ineffective. And that despite our intuition that we should tell people, the best way to influence people frequently is through understanding. That's if you want to influence them. There are obviously certain situations where you don't want to influence them. You have to do other things outside of influence. Jayasara, I just want to come to you again, if you don't mind, on when you were speaking to Emil, you spoke about the ultimate responsibility is with ourselves, no matter what the conditions. The world is dysfunctional. Bad things are going to happen. The ultimate responsibility is with ourselves. Is there a time when you think that that can lead to blaming the victim?
It could, if it's not understood properly. But what I mean by take responsibility for yourself, that doesn't cancel out taking action in the world. But it means that whatever action you take in the world comes from a much deeper place of self-awareness and understanding, so that whatever action you take is not about changing or forcing Vladimir Putin to be any other way, but whatever action you take towards Vladimir Putin is going to be informed from a place of self-awareness. So, you know, I think both Sonia and I realize that you can't deal with someone like Vladimir Putin in the way that people perhaps fantasize. I'm going to tell him what to do and he's going to fix the world and I'm going to be the hero because I've saved the world, which is what that whole scenario was about. It's recognizing that, yeah, we do want to change people, and that's part of the problem. But when people feel that they're not being judged and that you have unconditional acceptance of them, even what we would deem horrible tyrants, but we're not judging them like that. We see them as a suffering human being. Then change will happen naturally. But we're not sitting there going, okay, well, if I send him metta, then that's going to change him either. It's not having an agenda. But it does recognize through one's own practice that you see that when you come from a place of unconditional love and acceptance, things change in the world and in other people. So you get out of the way. If you get out of the way with your own agenda and ideas and desire to control others and the world, it's a much better place to be. It's a much more effective and powerful place. So it's a place of compassion.
Jayasara, you've chosen a monastic life. Why have you chosen, it would seem to me, quite an extreme life rather than just to be a practitioner?
It doesn't feel extreme to me. It feels like I'm living the life that resonates most for me, that's supportive in my practice. And nothing I do is particularly extreme either. But maybe the outfit, the gear, can't help that. That's part of the tradition that we've inherited. But when I go to bed at night and meditate, I get into my tracksuit pants, you know, but nothing I do in my life is particularly extreme. But maybe to some people it is, because I'm celibate. I don't drink alcohol and I don't eat after 1 p.m. I don't have a job. I don't earn money. I rely on the goodwill and support of others. That's it. Pretty radical.
I think, Emil, on that note, I'm going to thank both of you. The principle of charity also demands that we don't disdain complexity. We don't simplify things down to one idea and therefore dismiss others. And I would say my experience of both of you is exactly that. I just have loved your way of communicating around the nuances, the complexity of the other, some of the self-criticism. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast and really appreciate it. Emil, any final words from you?
It's just been fantastic. And I love the way that both the traditions turn the spotlight back on the questioner, because in the end of the day, that's the most powerful way we can influence or not influence. I guess in the end of the day, there's a limit to what you can do from the outside and not from the inside. So it's been great to hear both the approaches, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this discussion, we'd really appreciate a review wherever you get your podcasts. And we encourage you to hop onto our Principle of Charity socials and get involved in the conversation yourself. See you next time.
We're at the end of an era and on the precipice of a new one. What do we keep? What do we leave behind? Hear from 16 thinkers, including Stephen Fry, Roxane Gay, Slavoj Zizek, Waleed Ali, Naomi Klein, Peter Singer, Sam Mostyn, and more. 8 conversations, 8 responses in sound, 1 podcast to record this moment. Subscribe to the Festival of Dangerous Ideas wherever you find your podcasts, and join us at the in-between.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.